This is a very special episode, our Q&A episode of World's Greatest Con. I'm Brian Brushwood, joined live in studio by my co-creator, Justin Robert Young. How you doing, Justin?
Great, Brian.
I think I was 47 years old when this happened. And we had just released a major project. The second, in fact. It was after the second season of World's Greatest Con, my co-creator, Justin Robert Young, came to me and said,
"Hey, Brian, we need to do the Q&A.
And it was at that moment I had a totally independent thought. We should do the Q&A. And that's when it all hit me that this would be our question and answer episode, the triumphant final crowning of our second season of World's Greatest Con.
It's going to sound good with all the music.
It's going to sound good.
In fact, it just did. It did sound good for everybody.
Maybe before we even begin, we could talk about sort of the voice of a podcast and how it's something that you discover and not something you decide.
Yeah. Yeah. You find it. I mean, we certainly did not set out to make the voice of this show what it became. It was very much a product of, I think kind of where we were. I mean, like, it very much is a child of the pandemic. Like, it is a child of introspection and escapism and all these things that I think everybody was feeling during lockdown. And obviously, you know, how much of your soul is kind of bared in the show.
It suddenly occurs to me that somewhere is that very first recording, because all of this began with the phone call of you calling me randomly saying, "Hey, if you could have a show about anything, what would it be?" I'd be like, "Oh, it'd be about World's Greatest Cons." Yeah. And then you immediately asked, "Great, what's the World's Greatest Con?" And I was like, "Oh, it's gotta be Operation Mincemeat." And you said, "Great, what's that?" And I started to explain. I got about two sentences in and you were like, "Stop talking. I'm going to hang up. You're going to press record on a voice memo. Just talk."
Yeah.
and so it all began. And then that's where only iteratively do we get to the point where we had this kind of sweeping epic narrative, this mixture of small world and big world and personal and historical that brought us to this moment, which gets me to the question I want to ask you, which was, despite all of my confidence and bravado, secretly, I wasn't entirely sure of myself when you asked, "Okay, we just covered the world defeating Hitler. What would you like to do next?" And I said, "How about this? TV game shows.
Yeah, I think when we were first spitballing for season two, the biggest things that I think we couldn't have with a story as big as Mincemeat is relatability or familiarity with the world. Like the fun thing about that story is the escapism of like, oh, what would it be like to be in this all or nothing thing? And bringing you to these worlds was a really fun.
The first season really could just as easily have been about the rebels' plan to deceive Palpatine. You know, that's how far our generation is from that story.
But if you have an element of familiarity or relatability, that is something that at least we hadn't done before. And also you need stakes. And that's where it's like, I knew we had that with game shows. We had familiarity and we had relatability with game shows. Did we have the stakes? Like,
right.
Cause no matter what, you can't beat Hitler twice, but like, you have to have something that people care about. And that was my biggest, the nut that eventually had to get cracked as we were into our research phase, which by the way, comes after we decide
what we're going to do, Right.
Like we already chartered the boats. We got the crew.
We decided where we're going. And then comes the question. So what's there?
Is it worth it?
Yeah.
Right. And I think it was into the research for the quiz show stuff when, as soon as I think we cracked the reputational element of it, which is just not discussed at all.
Well, and I think
I was
again,
like, oh, we got something. There's a deeper, there's some very good World's Greatest Con
treasures in this genre.
Well, and I think the beginning of episode one really speaks to that, where there are those who are familiar with the story of the scandal as it was unfolding. You know, some of our older listeners watched it as it unfolded live. Some folks had seen the movie in the 90s,
yep.
But you and I were really struck by just this one odd artifact of the perjuring. And it's like, nobody's really talking about that. And there are times in our process where we go back and we clarify, we re-record, we get more precise answers, we discover what's there.
Yeah.
But almost a completely unbroken monologue in that hypnosis bit at the beginning of episode one. Mm-hmm. And much like in season one, that's the way it was when I spoke candidly about my brother.
Yeah.
But in this case, it did help that I had traveled for 10 years with a hypnotist who I love dearly. And I think you commented later that it's like, yeah, that was a really good impression of a hypnotist show. So good, it makes me think it's not an impression, so but somebody's actual show.
You're just describing, we should say.
Well, it was a blend of a couple of different hypnotists, but the induction and the rhythm that I'm talking about is me channeling CJ Johnson.
Yeah, shout out to CJ.
Yeah, somebody who I toured with to colleges. We actually toured with, of all bands, Brooks and Dunn, Rascal Flatts, and Brad Paisley back in the day. I got to hear that induction a lot.
Yes. Yeah. No, we ran into CJ at a thing for your wife's, art, a few weeks ago. And it was the first time that I'd seen him since the episode came out. And I was like, so you heard the episode? And he's like, yeah, it's great. I'm like, how'd you like your entire act being exposed in, our intro for the season? And he's like, oh, it's great. And I'm like, thank God. Thank God.
Very happy about that. You had the wisdom to ask that after it was published.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, it was too good to not to ask permission, right? But
before we dive in on the specific questions, I do want to comment really quick that a side benefit, as hard of a left turn as it was to go from Hitler to game shows, to go from a big story in chapters to small anthologies, that was such an important flex for our own storytelling benefit, because once you have set the spectrum that wide,
yeah,
that means we get to tell any tale of deception at any time. It could be current news. It could be past news. It could be firsthand accounts. It could be speculation from thirdhand accounts, and on and on and on.
Yeah. And, you know, without, we can't get into where we're going, but you know, there's a lot of stuff in the middle between those two points, and I'm very, very excited to dig into it.
But all right, what questions we got?
Let's focus on the season that we just did. Edward wrote in, and this is something that we get a lot, so I just figured we can address it. Wouldn't the world's greatest con be one that we don't know about and they got away with it undetected?
That would be number one, 100% correct. Number two, a very, very short podcast. So let's do it right now.
Yeah.
This is World's Greatest Con. I'm Brian Brushwood. Somewhere, somehow, a con was pulled off so perfect that they got the most money and they never got caught. The end. This episode of World's Greatest Con was created by...
No, come on, we can get a better help at it.
Okay, all right.
All right, Chris writes, this is about episode one. A question that came to my mind that I wondered if you guys had any info on. Why did 21 broadcast live instead of recording it? This seems like they were opening themselves up to the risk of somebody going rogue instead of sticking to their lines without the luxury of editing or recording later on. Was this just because of the time period? Because I'm struggling to think of many game shows that air live.
This is something that I find this stuff fascinating, because if you're young enough, that is a very sensible question.
Yes.
But if you're old enough, that is a hilarious question.
Yeah. Right. It is very similar to the question of, well, why didn't Michael Larson just put into a spreadsheet on his computer all of the serial bills. Numbers and he could just search on his iPad and he would find it immediately.
And by the way, I don't want to take anything away from the question. It is a good question, but
yes.
To give historical context, this is what, 1964 or
1956.
Yeah. Okay. So understand that at that time, Television really is just radio with pictures.
Yes.
And magnetic tape storage was only barely getting discovered. In fact, it was not until after World War II, as people, as the Allies were looting German stores, that they discovered high quality magnetic tape recorders. There were people whose contracts stipulated that they absolutely would only do their show live because it sounded like garbage if it was ever recorded.
Yeah.
There were some video recorders that would use, and this part I might get wrong because we're not fact checking and all that stuff. We're doing this live to tape, but a single like thread of steel that they would use magnetic recordings on. But all pretty much anything you see from the 1950s is, I'm going to look at our producer, John, who might know, I think it's called a kinetoscope. Is that what it's called? John Hess from Filmmaker IQ has a wonderful series on all of this stuff. And I'm certain he would know the specific answer. I think it's called a kinetoscope, but basically it's just a straight up television broadcasting here in America, NTSC. Over in Europe, it would be PAL, 24 frames per second. It gets technical, but they would straight up just have a film camera pointed at a television. Yeah. That's how we have all of the footage from I Love Lucy. It's yep. how we have all of the footage from any of the game shows. That is a film camera pointed at essentially a radio.
Yeah.
So understand that there were significant technological barriers at the time. And it's remarkable that we have as much as we do.
The first commercially successful VCR. You have any idea on when it was released to the public?
I know that the most, from a legal perspective, important VCR was in the 1970s, the Betamax, because it went all the way to the Supreme Court, forcing the Betamax decision in which time shifting your programming became allowed. So I'll go out on a limb and say Betamax by Sony.
1956.
What?
The same year that we are talking about for the quiz show scandals. Any idea on what it cost?
Well, adjusted for inflation, I'll say all the money.
All of it. Yes. $50,000.
Holy moly.
$50,000 is what they went for. And this is something that I covered on the Raise the Dead podcast, but like, if you really look at John F. Kennedy's mastery of the media and his team's mastery of the media, it's not in the debates, which I think are misinterpreted and overhyped, but rather that he bought one of those VCRs.
So that he could essentially watch the dailies.
Not only could he record and critique his own performance and continue to refine it, but they also would cut
packages.
They would cut packages for local news. And so they would send 15, 30 second and minute clips, knowing that those were the holes that would go into packages. They would send that to television stations that would be in their interest with clips, with the messages they wanted to get out to those voters.
How remarkable that 50 years later, that's one of the most reviled practices out there, because it turns the news into propaganda where somebody else does your job for you.
Yep.
World's Greatest Con is brought to you by Blinkist. You know what they do. They take big ideas, big books, and condense them down into bite-sized chunks so that you can make the changes to your life to be a better person. This year, they want to empower people to grow personally and professionally by discovering content that inspires, motivates, and gives you new perspectives on your lives and into the world of 2022. With their new initiative, 22 Ideas for 2022, they want to focus on how Blinkist content can incredibly impact all of our lives. Me personally, I love the works of Ryan Holiday. His books, Ego is the Enemy, The Obstacle is the Way, introduced me to stoicism and the importance of making it through rough times. And it was really a treat to go back and re-experience the blinks of these. 13 minutes got me a refresher course on an entire book. And they have so many different titles. A Short History of Nearly Everything. Origin Story. A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived. All of these are going to make you better, and they're all written to be easy to digest. So jump right in, give it a free 7-day trial, and when you do sign up for the service, you'll get 25% off a Blinkist Premium membership if you head on over to Blinkist.com/WGC. That's Blinkist.com/WGC for World's Greatest Con to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/WGC.
Alex writes, I just finished listening to episode one and episode two. And the immediate question I had was, what was the outcome on the television industry? I think specifically with the quiz show scandals. Did the FCC issue some kind of rule or law book for game shows? Is there some mysterious game show host guild that runs the game show New World Order? Or is it somewhat of a Wild West when it comes to feeding answers and the honor system? Actually, no, that was Connor, not Alex. I apologize.
That's one of those that I'm just as curious as you are into the specifics of it. But early in the process, I wanted desperately to go all the way in the weeds on this stuff, to explore the question of game show itself is a curious phrase, because if it's a game that makes it a sport, which means prearranging the outcome is a crime. If it's a show, then it's professional wrestling, in which case it's no different than Shakespeare and anything goes, right? Reality programming is a show. But then you get into weird territory like your America's Got Talents or any kind of competition show that is a game show, which is technically a sport. And so I ultimately, early in the process, we realized that getting too far in the weeds would probably not make for good, fun, it just simple wasn't, stories.
It is a good episode. It just wasn't that episode,
you know,
it was, we, as soon as like we found the reputational element and, you know, you kind of realize that, oh wait, like there's a cost for people to be living a lie in their most famous moment.
And as we found out in episode one, everyone before Dan Enright had been trading on that. Dan Enright was the first one where the bill came due. And Dan Enright, I'd hate to give credit to where it's due, but that dude had the sense to leave the country for a little bit and come back and pretend nothing happened.
I do have some information on this. So yes, the FCC does now have rules in terms of game shows that like absolutely everything needs to be above board. But it also is partly the reason why advertising is the way that it is right now. The concept of a commercial break with separate ads that you put in the center of it, as opposed to what we saw during that episode where it's, you know, brought to you by Geritol.
Right.
That was because with the shame that came along with those shows tanking, the advertisers were like, let's all agree that none of us should be putting our names so embedded into these things. Let's remove our culpability from television, you know, mistakes and misdeeds. And let's go to this less personal, hey, we're just running an ad like a magazine page, which is the metaphor that they described it with.
To this day, sort of a middle ground. We see it on Wheel of Fortune. We see it on The Price is Right, where it's like promotional consideration, products provided by. So they're essentially ads, but they're not.
In ways, we've seen it come back.
Yeah.
We've seen the idea of like, okay, well now everybody hates ads. Everybody skips stuff. DVR has crushed the concept of people sitting around and watching anything live. So now you kind of need to bake it more into the show. You are closer to the idea of title sponsors.
Even in a competition reality show that takes itself very seriously, like let's say Survivor or whatever, the branding of the flat screen television that they're fighting for will be very, very clear.
Oh, for sure. Oh yeah. No, totally. The last show that I could remember that made a joke about this was the Dana Carvey show, which each episode had a different title sponsor of like Taco Bell or Mug Diet Root Beer or whatever.
They were all Pepsi.
Brands. I don't know. Well, you know, one of them was Mountain Dew. So I guess it was all probably Yum, but, there is a documentary about that series that has the funniest clip because they're highlighting the fact that on ABC, they were after Home Improvement and they were this very avant-garde, crazy sketch show.
And to be clear, this is a comedy sketch show in prime time, right?
Yes.
In the early 90s, that was supposed to be Dana Carvey's ascendancy.
Post-SNL, he was going to do this thing. He was going to keep doing all these SNL characters that people loved on his own thing. But the clip is a promo for Home Improvement, and it's an episode where Jonathan Taylor Thomas's character has a cancer scare.
Oh, geez.
And so it's a very special episode, capital letters for everything.
ABC Tuesday, a parent's worst fear, losing a child.
I don't want to die, Dad.
And you never know whose family it will happen to. An episode so powerful, it hits home.
We beat this thing, no matter what it is, you know? I'm not letting anything happen to you.
A special Home Improvement followed by the Diet Mug Root Beer Dana Carvey Show.
I wonder why they got canceled immediately.
Yeah, yeah. So it's been a haunted and fraught concept ever since the quiz show.
Although weirdly, in the early days of video on the internet, it came back with a vengeance. So says somebody who participated in a lot of it. The most popular clip on the Scam School series continues to be sitting at 20 million views. The episode that contains a 2-minute segment in which I explain that using Netflix, you can have DVDs sent to you via the mail.
All right. 18-ish years ago, writes Grant, my best friend and I were out at a hypnotist show in Waterloo. The selection trick was having your hands stuck together, and my friend was committed. He couldn't get them apart even after not getting selected, even with my help. Being as he was like a brother to me, I let him suffer until he sorted it all out, even finished his beer for him. What's family for? If I hadn't been a poor student at the time, I'd have bought the showman around, if only for the side entertainment that he gave me. Turns out my friend went to another show later that year, got picked, did the humiliating things, convinced himself he was really out of control, and took a month for his trigger phrases to wear off. He gets his validation now doing semi-amateur stand-up shows. Can't wait to hear what else you have this season. And you definitely triggered some fun memories with these framing devices.
If there's one regret I have about that opening, it's that hypnotism itself unfairly gets collapsed into one concept when it's really many different concepts in very different situations. I spoke very specifically about why the pressure, the social pressure to comply is so important to a stage hypnotist act. Now, having said that, even stage hypnotists, maybe, and I've spoken to several, they all agree that, like, in general, that's how it goes. And that's why reliably they can put on a show. But let's say 1 in 100 people, 1 in 100 humans. So say once every 3 shows, you get somebody who truly is very, very good at instantly going into what I believe is called a hypnagogic state. And when people ask what hypnosis is it real? I always ask them, have you ever cried at a movie, ever laughed at a movie? And I say, great, congratulations, you've been hypnotized. You're laughing at a thing that never happened to people who never existed.
Yeah.
This is a fantasy that you were guided to make real in your mind, real enough that you had a physical response to it, right? As you would imagine, various people have different abilities to instantly access that state. I think that that's part of what makes actors particularly skilled and talented at what they do, because they're told in exactly 2 minutes, you're going to need to visualize and experience the death of your father and go on cue, right? That's very, some people can do that. Some people cannot. So to the stage hypnotist, when they encounter somebody who easily slips all the way into a hypnagogic state, boy, oh boy, do they have a good time.
Yeah.
Because there's like, that's the part where the stage hypnotist is having as much fun as the audience. And so to your friend, I would encourage you, the way I described it made it sound like it's only the social pressure cue that is making it happen. But please allow for, because the way the hand sticking together experiment works is that they give you 2 conflicting commands. One is the harder you try to pull your hands apart, the more they will be stuck together. And if you are truly trying your best to follow instructions, then quite literally, if you have the right type of brain for it, you will experience this unreal supernatural, like, the harder I'm pulling apart, the more they stick together. I don't understand it, which of course is the social proof that gets you to go up on stage, and there's only more social proof. And then from that point forward, we're closer to the story as I told it, but please trust me when I say, boy, oh boy, don't reduce all hypnotism to my story. No. My story is a rough outline of why, in general, stage hypnotism works.
As an entertainment form.
As a reliable entertainment form.
Reliably can go in the same way that you can sing a song
and you can do a dance. You can also do these things. But that's what you were describing.
I will double down on the surreality of the vast majority of people on stage in general tend to have never been on stage before. They've never entered the so-called flow state of being totally present in the moment, only thinking of performing and doing what's funny. And there truly is, after the show's over, this amnesiac effect. It's most performers have experienced it, but if you ain't performed, then it's going to feel like weird hypno magic to you.
Yeah. Marin wrote in, do you think a lot of people who perpetrate cons have an inflated sense of their own intelligence, or that they assume others are less intelligent based off their own wants? I personally think that it's a combination of the two. As you say on the show, they try and target dishonest people, but the story in our fourth episode, and that was our Carrie Ketchum password episode, makes me question a lot of this, because surely he would have realized that he would be recognized on television, right?
Well, let's start with that specific case. That is straight up a cornered rat. And if you have ever seen Los Angeles television be interrupted for a live car chase, you see every manner of crazy move tried in the last desperate moments before they know they're going to be captured by the police. You see them moving from one car to another, jumping over fences, hiding in crazy places and all that stuff. To me, that's where Carrie Ketchum was at. Yes, calculated risk. Hopefully I'll have the money by the time this airs and I'll be out of town. Turns out not so much.
I also think that this is something that ages differently. Like in that realm, even in the 80s, and yes, at that point there were the concept of media permanence was kind of beginning to dawn. Like you said, that is more the age of Betamax and stuff like that. So the concept of this is kind of there. I do think that fundamentally we think of media in a different way, where now if somebody were in that situation that Ketchum was, it would not be if, it would be when, right, somebody would find it, because even though there is, you know, as much media as there's ever been, it's all recorded effectively forever. And right, and somebody would see it and somebody would share it going forward.
Well, and there's a Soft Target on one of my other podcasts. We're doing a rewatch of the original Miami Vice series show that was originally shot in standard definition, I guess on film, but broadcast at standard definition on 4x3, never recorded, never replayed, all, you know, just on a Friday night, you caught it or you didn't. And it is so much fun, knowing just a little bit about production, to press pause on Don Johnson's face and look, zoom in on his sunglasses, and then, you know, screen capture and, you know, snarkily text to all my friends, like a nice shot of the boom operator, eh?
Yeah. You
know, all this stuff that nowadays we would think of, but there was no reason to think of back in the day.
No, absolutely not. I actually screwed up and did not get the name for this one. So apologies to the person who wrote this, but it's true that 21 was the best known of the rig shows, to the point that it probably most people that know of these things think of it first if you mention the quiz show scandals. But I think it would have been worth mentioning another show called Dotto, which was a quiz based on Connect the Dots. I don't know if this came up during your research. Indeed it did. It was just, you know, not the story that we were
telling. Well, and to pull back the curtain a little bit on the process, you see this in season one. The reason we have it split into four chapters is because each of the four chapters teaches a different lesson about the way our brains are flawed,
yeah,
and a different lesson about the underworld and a different chapter of the big story. So in this case, we have independent stories. You'll notice that all five in the anthology, the first one begins with the landscape, the why do we care? And, yeah, you know, this is the powerful abusing the weak. And then the second one is the weak breaking the game of the powerful and the consequences of the type of brain that can do that, what happens to them. The third episode is, I might've gotten a little bit fired up about the heist pulled in that one. The fourth episode is, to my mind, my favorite, because it's the uncomfortable question of what happens when a bad guy does good. Answer, yeah, he still gets screwed. And then the fifth episode is just a straight up whodunit with where we get to explore why memory is so flawed. And so in that framework, when we get two stories that are similar enough, we kind of have to pick a winner and a loser for that chapter. Now, it doesn't mean we can't go back and tell that story in a different season, in a different context.
It really is the beginning of that story. It was just a decision to kind of skip further down the road. So we were closer to the kind of big, I mean,
to the world we spend most of the time in.
Yeah, it really, the decision was made with that episode that the real conflict was between Stemple and Enright. And to do that, we just need to start with Enright and then shortly after introduce Stemple. But for Dotto, the story with Dotto is fascinating. It's another Enright, Barry and Enright production. They were indeed cheating. And the way that the entire grand jury that eventually plays a big pivotal role in our episode got started was because a dude said he was he lost on Dotto because his opponent had the answers. And the way he knew it was because she had written down all of the answers and he found it in her diary, which she had left backstage.
Oh, wow.
And so that's what gets the ball rolling for the grand jury. And that's a fascinating thing. I'm glad we're able to talk about it now, because if you really like the season, you should know this because it is very interesting. But it wasn't the story that we were telling, which was about reputation and all that. And that's why we got right into where we got.
Yeah. Look, man, if you're in the business of doing YouTube and TV stuff, your face is your moneymaker. Guess what? If you exist in society, your face is your moneymaker. Take care of your face. Have good skin. Go and visit our friends over at Geology. Geology is a 9-time award-winning men's skincare company recognized in Men's Health, Esquire, and Ask Men Grooming Awards. They got 5,000 plus 5-star reviews. People love this stuff. Geology puts together a simple, effective skincare routine customized just for you with ingredients that are proven to work and formulated to use every single day. Their skincare is built around just a handful of powerful, proven ingredients, stuff that has been trusted by dermatologists for decades. Real ingredients like retinol, niacinamide, and kojic acid. They don't do dandelion root extract or sage leaf oil. They'll leave that to the other jokers. Geology is one of the only men's skincare companies to have retinol as an active ingredient in their products. That means they can help you fight acne, reduce oiliness, prevent wrinkles, combat dark or puffy under eyes. And the best part is, to get started, you take a simple 30-second quiz. You say exactly what your concerns are. Mine, sometimes I get a little bit shiny. I always need to put powder on my face. I worry about getting all wrinkly so I look too old. Then they put together a personalized skincare regimen just for you. Take care of your face. It's your moneymaker. Skincare is a science. Take the guesswork out of it. You don't want to be gambling. And don't be fooled by the marketing fluff and a list of ingredients like papaya extract from Peru. Spoiler alert, those are fancy marketing words. We're only talking ingredients that actually make a difference on your skin. Start off with a 5-piece trial set valued at $50 by heading on over to geology.com/greatestcon. Geology.com/greatestcon. That's geology.com/greatestcon. You'll be keeping us in business. You'll be keeping your moneymaker looking good. And most importantly, you'll be taking the guesswork out of the voodoo of skincare. Start with a 30-day trial of all 5 products. Twice everyday face wash, vital morning face cream, repeating night cream, and nourishing eye cream. You get 2 bottles of the face wash, so you can have 1 in your bag, 1 in the shower. When you fall in love, continue with 90-day supplies of all the products you dig the most. Subscribe and save, or just go a la carte. You're in total control. That's 50% off your 30-day trial at geology.com/greatestcon.
Justin writes, I had a friend in the Army whose wife was from North Pole, Alaska. He gets drugged into an office one day and threatened with Article 15, punishment in the military where they reduce your rank, fine you, and make you do extra work because they believed he had falsified a form. Turns out, when he listed his wife's residence as North Pole, somebody thought he was being funny, didn't bother to check if it was a real place or not. This was in 2001, and nobody had a smartphone for instant fact-checking. But still.
If it makes you feel any better, I was 1 year earlier when I found out that North Pole was a place, too. That's amazing, though.
All right, this is a great one. Marco writes, here in Switzerland, everything's a bit smaller and slower. So were our game shows and the stakes. In 1999, Tommaso Raimondo was caught cheating on the popular game show Rischio. They did the training sessions with the audience, but fake candidates had real questions. So a helper wrote the right answers down and hid them for the actual contestant behind a toilet. That candidate reviewed the answer, memorized them, so he could play on the show. It blew up because he got mixed up on the order of the answers and gave the answer confidently to the next question.
Oh, no.
So let's say, for example, he gave the answer to question number five.
Right.
For question four.
So like the first question is like, what's the capital of Arizona? And I say, George Washington Carver.
And yeah. And the next one is who invented the peanut? The peanut.
Yeah.
The next question, Das Ich de Fußballer Moldovan Giz.
Nailed it.
Which apparently was so popular, became such a meme, it was made into a song that was popular in Switzerland because this was its own little mini scandal. They finished the recording and even aired the show, but it led to an investigation and a trial where it was revealed that he and his two friends had pulled a stunt like this a few years earlier as well. Our national television was scolded for naivete, and the people got sentences on probation. On the TV side, the only consequence was, as far as it's publicly known, that they used a different set of questions going forward for preparation.
Which, wow.
Probably smart. You want to know what? It's a good change.
Seems like you should do that. It's astonishing how, I mean, this is one of those human moments, right? It's not only the humanity that gets us to fall for the scams, but it's also the humanity that reveals the frauds.
Yeah. Yeah. But I, it was one of those things where I looked at it and I was like, oh man, we should do like a little mini episode or something, but you really can't pull foreign language stuff and have it play.
What's funny is I have a personal anecdote that I really want to share right now about accidentally becoming complicit in a fraud giveaway.
But we're going to save it because it's a really good story.
That's correct.
And it's going to make a really good intro one day and we don't want to burn it in the Q&A episode. That is the face of bare white knuckle restraint from Brian Brunswick right now.
This is as good as it gets.
Finally, last question. Joey wrote, do serial numbers on $1 bills have a pattern? Like if it's printed in New York, does it start with a certain series of numbers? And if it's printed at another mint, would it start with another series of numbers? Could it be possible that the radio contest for Michael Larson was unwinnable, that they were using totally random numbers that could never be created?
I think we had to do the thing where we're just careful on our language to make sure we're accurate.
We don't know.
Okay.
That's the answer.
We can find no confirmation of the exact rules of the we can find no confirmation of the exact rules of the contest.
Yes.
And so, but we do know for a fact that involved the radio calling out some random numbers. If you had the bill that matched it, you won. And you do the math. Michael Larson certainly thought he would win and pull this off.
Effectively, the bulk of that story comes from the common law wife. She is the one that drives the narrative in the game show documentary. And by all accounts, we are trusting her at her word that is the reason why there was all these bills that he had removed from the bank.
It's worth noting that as we're recording this, of the second season, this is the first one that we've done our best to convert into a full on YouTube think piece video essay with lots of visuals and stuff. So right now I'm in the middle of getting a lot of emails that have strong opinions as to exactly how somebody would know all that cash was there on that night, and specifically casting aspersions on the common law wife. And I have responded, tell me if I'm wrong on this, that your take is that it's a small town. It's not rocket science. If you knew
it ain't exactly Bel Air. It ain't exactly Brentwood. He was not living in a super rich area. He was probably the most famous person in town. And word gets around really, really, really fast if $50,000 in loose bills are laying around.
So at this point, now that we've wrapped up season two, I suppose before we speculate wildly about what the future holds for us, we should remind everybody a heartfelt thanks to all of our patrons over at patreon.com/greatestcon. We didn't know if using the Patreon model was going to work after season one, especially because we made a move that we had never made before, which was to promise essentially nothing, only promise that you would get episodes faster, better, and sooner, and you would never hear an ad. And
yeah,
we were able to keep those promises. However, month after month after month, as that support comes rolling in and we have to keep our lips sealed and we have to just give one update per month where we're like, it's coming,
yeah,
was agony. And you have no idea. I mean, I would love to hear your take on it, but oh my God, I felt like 1,000,000 pounds of pressure was off my chest the moment we were able to start releasing in season two.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think from my perspective with like the Dog and Pony Show production element of it, it just is the difference of night and day of being able to bring people on and pay them, you know, the money that they deserve to be paid to make the show. It helps in so many ways. And, you know, especially going into, you know, what we're doing, you know, with the new season is like, that there's going to be some resources that need to be spent. Like this is not going to be like anything that we've ever done before. And that requires money and, you know, money in production, I think buys you coupons. If you're on a deadline, it buys you coupons to do things over. It buys you coupons to do things right. It buys you coupons to say, no, stay on this project and let's make it exactly what we need it to be. And I think for a show like this, that's important.
I know that we have a blood oath that we will not speak about any specifics of season three. But I think I'm not ruining anything from the money side of things by saying that the patronage is allowing us to do things like book flights to meet people in person.
Yes.
That's as much as I'll say about season three. And going forward, if you want to see that level of increase in production and storytelling, then by all means, please head over to patreon.com/greatestcon.
And that was the thing that we didn't have initially that now we do, is that annual payment. So if you just would like to kick
us, get it over with, rip off that Band-Aid.
Exactly. You can do that now. Before we go though, although this is traditionally the end of our season, I do think that we can tease out the fact that we're going to have a feed drop next week.
Yep. So for those who are not familiar with the term, what does that mean for them?
That's when another amazing podcast allows us to put one of their awesome episodes in our feed. And we will in turn also be able to have our podcast be played for all of their audience.
As a matter of fact, awesome. A pretty good chunk of the folks listening right now, it was entirely because Jack Reesider over at Darknet Diaries just decided, I was like, hey man, can you give a plug or whatever? He's like, nah, I'm just going to drop the whole episode in. And I was like, that works as well. Oh, yeah, sure.
That's okay. Cool. Thank you, Jack. Big shout out to Jack.
What a hero.
What a hero. What a legend. But also within the next few weeks, this won't be the last time that you hear Brian's voice. We're going to have maybe a little interview?
I don't want to give details out, but if you liked season one and you want to hear somebody very qualified to talk to me about season one, maybe in the context of something else, stick around because I think I might have an interview with someone.
Yeah, we really want to reward you guys because you have been so great to this show. You've been so supportive of getting this out there. So any extra content that we can bring you in between seasons is something that we're always going to strive to do.
And before we wrap up, one thing, the most important thing is if anybody knows whether it's McFadian or McFadian, let me know because we found examples of both all over the place and you can hear we recorded some one way, some the other way.
Probably
the easiest thing would be if somebody knows Matthew, it could just reach out.
If you could really just have him contact us directly, that would be the best. worldsgreatestcon@gmail.com.
The liar man.
But if you want, look, man, that's out there. The liar man is ready. It is poised.
Okay. Thank you to everybody for the support. Don't be shy about reaching out to both of us on Twitter. I'm at Schwood. That's S-H-W-O-O-D. Justin is at Justin R. Young, all spelled the way it sounds. Thank you guys. As you continue to make dreams come true, know that in our hearts, the world's greatest con was when you made us fall in love with you. Too cheesy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect. Do the line.
Wait. Oh, hold on. Okay. You know what? I suspect someday there'll be a convention where we'll meet face to face. And when that happens, it will be the world's greatest con.
You don't want it
No.
Con's not foolish because you're stupid. They're foolish because you're human.
Okay, all right. Third take. Sure. All right. Till then, just remember, people, cons don't fool us because we're stupid. They fool us because we're human. And everything that we're pulling on you just might be the world's greatest con. Love you guys.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.